okay, the Zerg are all around me, and the Protoss are overrunning my base, and I sleep so terribly, and I keep waking up, like, oh, you know. So beginning back sleep is probably why I'm sick. So there's someone else who's having bad dreams, dreams that are keeping them up at night, and that's Nebuchadnezzar. So we're studying chapter 4 of Daniel, and Nebuchadnezzar has been having these crazy dreams that keep waking him up tense at night. So we're going to look at that passage today. It's Daniel 4. If you'd like to stand for the reading of the word. In verse 4 begins, I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house and prospering in my palace. I saw a dream that made me afraid. As I lay in bed, and the fancies and the visions of my head alarmed me. So I made a decree that all the wise men of Babylon should be brought before me, that they might make known to me the interpretation of the dream. Then the magicians, the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers came in, and I told them the dream, but they could not make known to me its interpretation. At last, Daniel came in before me, he who was named Belteshazzar, after the name of my God, and in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And I told him the dream, saying, O Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, because I know that you have the spirit of the holy gods in you, and that no mystery is too difficult for you, tell me the visions of my dreams that I saw, and their interpretation. The visions of my head, as I lay in bed, were these. I saw, and behold, a tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. The tree grew and became strong, and its top reached to heaven, and it was visible to the end of the whole earth. Its leaves were beautiful, and its fruit abundant, and in it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it, and the birds of heaven lived in its branches, and all flesh was fed from it. I saw in the visions of my head as I lay in bed, and behold, a watcher, a holy one, came down from heaven. He proclaimed aloud and said thus, chop down the tree and lop off its branches, strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the beasts flee from under it and the birds from its branches, but leave the stump of its roots in the earth. Bind it with a band of iron and bronze amid the tender grass of the field. Let him be wet with the dew of heaven. Let his portion be with the beasts of the grass of the earth. Let his mind be changed from a man's, and let a beast's mind be given to him. And let 7 periods of time pass over him. This sentence is by the decree of the watchers, the decision by the word of the holy ones, to the end that the living may know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men, and gives it to whom he will, and sets it over the lowliest of men. This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, saw. And you, O Belteshazzar, tell me the interpretation, because all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known to me the interpretation of this dream. But you are able, because the spirit of the holy gods is in you. Then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was dismayed for a while, and his thoughts alarmed him. The king answered and said, Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation alarm you. Belteshazzar answered and said, my lord, may the dream be for those who hate you, and its interpretation for your enemies. The tree you saw, which grew and became strong so that the top reached to heaven, and it was visible to the end of the whole earth, whose leaves were beautiful, and whose fruit was abundant, and in which there was food for all, under which beasts of the field found shade, and in whose branches the birds of heaven lived. That tree is you, O king, who has grown and become strong. Your greatness has grown, and it reaches to heaven, and your dominion to the ends of the earth. And because the king saw a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven and saying, chop down the tree and destroy it, but leave the stump of its roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron, and in the tender grass of the field, And let him be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts of the field, till seven periods of time pass over him. This is the interpretation, O king. It is a decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king, that you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. You shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and you shall be wet with the dew of heaven, and seven periods of time shall pass over you, till you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. And as it was commanded to leave the stump of the roots of the tree, your kingdom shall be confirmed for you from the time that you know that heaven rules. Therefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable to you. Break off your sins by practicing righteousness, and your iniquities by showing mercy to the oppressed, that there may perhaps be a lengthening of your prosperity. And then the king stopped sinning, and none of the things in the dream came to pass. Just kidding. That's not how it happened. You can sit down. As this chapter continues, we find out that Nebuchadnezzar just keeps doing the stuff that Daniel said, hey, why don't you stop these things? And he ends up spending 7 years wandering around outside like a cow eating grass not ruling his kingdom. He has a really crazy time. He has a really crazy time until he finally looks up to heaven and recognizes that, recognizes that God is the source of all majesty and the source of his kingdom. There was an easy way for Nebuchadnezzar to learn this lesson. God sent him this warning in this dream and said, hey, you should recognize this. And even, like, Daniel comes and tells him very literally, like, hey, this is the thing you need to learn. Like, this is what the warning is about. But Nebuchadnezzar doesn't get that message. There's, the easy way, right, is to just hear this, observe it, learn from it, and then respond, like, change what he's doing. And a lot of times we are in the same situation, right? We have this chance to learn a lesson from books or blogs. Any way you want to grow or learn, you can go on YouTube. There's a video for that. So what we're doing right now, like, the whole point of sermons and, like, meeting at churches is so that we have this really efficient way to grow and learn from each other. There's also, like, avenues where you can get much more personal growth from, like, counseling or talking to your friends and family for advice. These kind of methods, these warnings, like this dream that Nebuchadnezzar gets, are very efficient. They're very fast. They're less painful for us, and they don't hurt other people. But, like Nebuchadnezzar, we end up doing something different, which is we don't learn the lesson from the warning. We have to go and experience the lesson ourselves. Nebuchadnezzar, of course, spends 7 years as a cow. He recognizes eventually that God is the source of majesty, and it exalts God. And this passage is actually just his testimony about how he came to know God. Lessons like this aren't optional. We've seen in previous parts of this book how Nebuchadnezzar seems to want to learn about God. He wants to address these spiritual things in his life. But the truth is, God has this agenda in for Nebuchadnezzar, whether or not Nebuchadnezzar wants to go through this process. God is going to teach us, and he's going to challenge us to grow. This process is called sanctification. We keep going back and forth. Is it like auto-advancing the slides or something? This process is called sanctification. It's the process of change and growth that takes us from where God has found us to where he wants us to be. You've all heard that there will be no sin in heaven. But then there's the question of, like, well, how, as a sinner, will I get to be there? How will I be able to live in heaven without messing it up myself? That actually is where sanctification comes in. Sanctification is the process of all our flaws being smoothed out and all of our wounds being healed. Like, to sanctify is to make holy. Jesus died so that we could be redeemed and begin the process of sanctification. The deal is done, and sanctification is going to happen. It's part of God's agenda for where we're going. The only question is how malleable or how resistant we're going to be. Do you want to run towards what God wants you to be, or do you want to hide from it? We see that Nebuchadnezzar is actually 7 years worth of resistance. We can see what that costs him, that dragging his feet. When I think about what losing 7 years of my life would be like if I went to prison or if I wandered around in the wilderness, I think back over the last 7 years of what I've done, and I think about all the things I've accomplished, everything that I've added to my resume in the last 7 years. Some of the most important people in my life, I wouldn't even know if it was not for the last 7 years. Think about all the money I've earned in 7 years. Think about all the things I've done in that time. And I think for Nebuchadnezzar, too, he's running this kingdom and trying to grow it and make it better. But think about the turmoil that would happen if your king, like, went crazy. And what would the kingdom happen? Like, can you imagine the vice king? He's just like, what do? Like, do we put him in a home? Do we anoint a new king? It's a super complicated situation that I'm sure really hindered his kingdom from growing for 7 years. Not to mention the discomfort of living outside and eating bitter grass, and it's cold and there are bugs and you get sick out there. He probably had kids or grandkids. He just missed out on 7 years of his life. So this was a pretty expensive lesson for Nebuchadnezzar to learn. And I've actually been thinking a lot about time in my own life because I'm unemployed right now, so what I have is lots of time. And it's funny because when I first started, I started having lots of time. I just kind of did whatever, just willy-nilly. And I realized, like, I started new hobbies. And then as time went on, I realized, like, I'm still not doing the things that I want to be doing if I didn't have a job. I'm just doing stupid stuff that doesn't matter. And so that made me really start to prioritize, like, okay, I have all this time. Am I going to spend it on the things that I care about? It's made me think a lot about my mortality, because there's a certain number of, like, minutes in my life that I will get to spend. And every time I spend something somewhere else, that's one less thing that I get to do. I have a certain number of days in the sun, a certain number of meals to eat, a certain number of projects that I can complete. I have lists and lists of things to do and lists of ways to come up with more lists of things to do, but I won't ever get to them. So that all reminds me about what it would be like to lose 7 of my 70 years crawling on my knees. But is this worth it? Is that worth it for Nebuchadnezzar to have learned this lesson? I think yes. It was totally worth it to see that kind of revelation, something that is so deep and true. To find God is totally worth 7 of your 70 years. But couldn't there be a cheaper way? Is there a discount that I can get? Sometimes there is. Sometimes there's a book, a warning, or a sermon. And when there is, it's our opportunity to jump at every chance to learn that lesson from other people's mistakes. If you seek out growth, you can get it for so cheap at wholesale. But there isn't always a book. Or we can't understand what the book says. Or our minds are too dense. Or our hearts are too stubborn. We can read something and it doesn't stick in our head. Or it doesn't penetrate to the core of who we are. It doesn't intermingle with our emotions or recalibrate our motivations. The book just can't reach that far inside of us. So we have to learn the way Nebuchadnezzar does by experiencing it. So what does that look like? How can we see that ahead of us as we walk forward on the path of sanctification? How do we stop ourselves from dragging our feet and resisting that growth? Well, one of the ways that we encounter growth as we walk through this lesson is by experiencing change. Either change in your circumstances, the change in the world around you, or change in the world inside of you. Your current circumstances have taught you all the lessons that you already know, and they haven't taught you the lessons that you haven't yet learned. So in order to grow, you must experience change. Even though it's difficult, even though it's uncomfortable, and it's so easy to resist change because it endangers our sense of security. But when we resist change, we resist God teaching and growing us. And most importantly, we resist God revealing himself and deepening our friendship with him. Change brings new ideas and new experiences and new motivations. For Nebuchadnezzar, he has a huge change. His whole life reorients, and everything that he had, he loses. I've seen something like, not quite so severe, but I've seen change work in my own life to help me grow. I grew up in a very small town in the mountains, and it was quite a different place than I think the rest of the world. It's full of timberjacks, which is sort of a special kind of redneck. And I was very eager to get out of that town. Particularly, I was like, I don't want to get turned into a redneck by staying here. It didn't work. I still have a lot of redneck in me. That's like a part of who I am. But when I ran out of there as fast as I could when I was 18, and I went to UC Santa Cruz, which is like basically the total opposite of the town I grew up in. And I remember when I first got there, I was in a program called EOP, which is for students who have some disadvantage that makes them less likely to graduate from college. I was there because my family was poor. I was the first generation in my family to go to college. One of my friends was also in the program, so we went to this ice cream social mixer, get to meet people event. And he was from Ecuador. He was a missionary kid who was born in the States, but then spent most of his childhood in Ecuador. And so we got there, and I realized, like, I was pretty uncomfortable. I didn't know why. It's just like, this place is not, not feeling good here. And he looked up, and he looked around, and he said, "We're the only two white people here." And I was like, oh my gosh, you're right. And he, being from Ecuador, just went off and spoke Spanish to some people. And I was just like, wow, this is really uncomfortable. Like, I've never been in a situation where I'm the minority. Like, I don't know what to do. And I actually ended up leaving early. But that was the beginning of a process of God using this change in circumstances to teach me about race and urban justice. And a lot of things that now are really important to me. And the truth is, if it wasn't for that experience that started in college, I wouldn't be at Harambe. One of the biggest reasons that I started coming here is because of our concern for racial reconciliation and urban justice. Those are really important things, both in my life and in the life of this church. This process, again, my circumstances changed after I graduated college. In those 4 years, I'd actually decided that I want to make these themes about race and justice a bigger part of my life. So I moved to inner city LA, thinking like, hey, I'm prepared. I've learned my lessons. I'm going to go, apply these things now. And oh my gosh, that was a totally different circumstance. I, again, was completely in the minority, didn't understand how things work. It was such a different world. I went through another, like, tier of culture shock. For example, for white people, totally normal, just go jogging, right? That's just the thing that is life. In the inner city, people don't go jogging. When you're running from something, it's because you just got mugged. So people would stop me and they're like, are you okay? And I'm like, yeah, I'm just jogging. people would stop and they'd be like, hey, are you selling mushrooms? I'm like, no. Why do you think that? It's because it's the only reason why people go to the inner city is to sell mushrooms. That was a shock, and it taught me to better understand and connect with people who are different than me and kind of let go of my own practices and experiences to connect with people. So, done the whole cross-cultural thing, and eventually I felt like God was leading me to something else. I moved to Orange County, which is totally the opposite, totally new context, huge change for me. If you haven't seen The OC, like you don't know what Orange County is about, like imagine Bellevue, but like twice as corporate and soulless. So, like just to give you an example, like it's so suburban. It's like the ultimate suburban area. The largest city in Orange County, Irvine, is actually owned by a corporation. It's like the Irvine Company went and bought a bunch of farms like 70 years ago and just said, we're going to make the perfect city, the perfect neighborhood. And it's crazy, too, because the city council actually kind of has to approve, they answer to the Irvine Corporation. And so when they want to do something, like, they have to go to the company and be like, hey, since you own everything, like, can we make this new park? And the Irvine Corporation approves it. It's totally working, though. Like, Irvine is the most beautiful, perfect city. I don't know, have you guys ever seen Get Out? Or it's like the movie that just played. It's this, like, you go to this perfect neighborhood, the movie, they go to this perfect neighborhood, and it's like, it's too good to be true. It's really kind of scary. Irvine is that way. Like, you go there and you're like, no, this can't be real. So I went from the inner city, the jungle, to this totally different place. And I thought that transition would be easy. But in reality, it was just as hard. I went through a similar culture shock. And I realized, like, hey, my discomfort zone at this point is actually middle-class white and Asian people. And that I had a lot of prejudice about the ways they spent their money and the choices they made in their lives. And again, God was using that change in my life to show me new things to learn. In this case, it wasn't some grand idea about justice or philosophy. It was just my own sin and the ways that I was, looking badly at other people. My growth in this area has been really hard, and it's been scary, and it's taken a really long time, but it's been worth it. And I'm very glad that God has brought me along this part of my sanctification. So there's another thing that God uses to take us on this path, and that's failure. From a very early age, we begin to think of failure as a bad thing. Something that we should avoid or downplay or deny or do everything we can to get away from. It's like a proof of our shortcomings, our insufficiency, and it's just a negative to be avoided. But I think that we're sort of misunderstanding failure's role in our life. I learned a really great lesson from a friend of mine, Rob Kennedy, who is a better engineer than I will ever be. In programming, when you're making software for a computer, there are things called variables. And basically, they're just a name for something else. It's like a number or a picture. And sometimes when you need to change this name or change the type of thing that it is from a number to a picture or back, when you make that change in one place, it breaks everything. Because all the places that refer to that variable now refer to the old name, and you have to go fix them all. So when I did this for years, I would write a really complex regular expression search to find all the places that we reference this variable. And every single time, my search wasn't good enough. I'd fix some of them, and I'd hit compile, and the computer would be like, nope, still broken. So I'd write a better regular expression. I'd do a better search, try again, And it was always a process, two or three times, oh, I forgot this, I'll add another wild card. And eventually I'd find them all, I'd hit compile, and it would work. But one day I was having a conversation with Rob, and we were talking about changing a variable, and he went ahead and just made the change, hit compile, without updating anything else. And I was like, it's going to break. He said, oh, no, don't worry. I'm just going to go through all the error messages and fix all the error messages, you know, one at a time. That's all the stuff that needs to be fixed. And I was like, oh, my gosh, that's the list. That's what I've been looking for every time I made these searches. And it's like I didn't see it because it was wrapped in a failure. And I expected that list to be wrapped in a success. And from that, I learned, like, you can just accept your failures and let your failures generate the data that you need to solve your problem. In engineering, this is actually a really common theme. We call it failing fast. So there's another really, I think, awesome example. Back in 1959, there was a pretty rich guy named Kremer who was really fascinated with airplanes and flight. And so he made this thing called the Kremer Prize. And it was 50,000 pounds for the first team that could make a human-powered plane. So, like, you're pedaling a bike or flapping your wings, Leonardo da Vinci style, that could fly an obstacle course, make turns, fly up to 10 feet in the air, and then land. He also made a second prize, which was a similar deal, but you had to fly across the English Channel. And for 18 years, nobody could do this. Like, in 1959, 50,000 pounds was a lot of money. And a lot of teams tried to win this prize, but they couldn't do it. Eventually in 1977, somebody named Paul McCready came along. And he basically made a giant model airplane out of plastic and scotch tape. And it was super light, and it flew really slowly. And one of the interesting things, he eventually went on to win this prize. And the thing that made a really big difference is as he was making this plane out of these really cheap materials, they would fail over and over again. They would crash. They would bust this thing up. But every time they could rebuild the plane super fast. They just get out more plastic and more scotch tape. And every time that they crashed, they began sort of iterating on their design. And they came up with a new way to build the plane. One time they crashed, and the whole fuselage was busted up. And later that afternoon, they had redesigned the whole thing, and the plane became 6 pounds lighter, which is a big deal because this thing was only like 80 pounds. They went through this process of failing and learning from their mistakes. And they grew a lot. And eventually, they won the prize. And then very quickly, like a couple months later, they decided, hey, we can actually just polish this design and, like, you know, fix up a few rough edges. And they, without doing any real redesign, flew all the way across the English Channel in 3 hours. They ended up winning 150,000 pounds plus the interest of 18 years. We see Nebuchadnezzar, too. Like, in chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar has sort of mastered failure, right? So we see the change in chapter 4, which we're studying today. But remember when he tried to burn those three guys in that oven because they wouldn't worship his statue? Like, that doesn't work. Remember, like, the people don't burn. And he accepts that failure. He immediately, like, right away when they come out of the fire, he's like, man, you guys were right. Your God can save you from my wrath. And he just accepts that lesson, accepts his failure. He's not upset about, oh, I couldn't burn these guys. He doesn't try plan B. He recognizes the lesson that he should see there. So what I want from you is I want you to equally not be afraid of your failure. I want you to be brave in the face of your shortcomings. Because they're stepping stones in your sanctification. As an application, today after the service finishes, before you leave, I want you to tell someone else about one time that you failed. Just to face that fear and push through it. I don't, no justifications, no excuses, just a story of a time that you failed when you tried to do something and you didn't succeed. Hopefully that will help us kind of get used to the idea that failure is not a bad thing. It's just part of the process. One way that I'm failing right now is, I've had sort of this, pillar of the way I want to live my life, which is I want to enter old age as a man who is daily shaped by the study of God and theology. And so the way I, do that is every day I study those things. But lately, over the last couple of months, I've been having a really hard time with that. It's been a real struggle, and it's definitely not been something that I would call daily. That's a way that I'm failing. I don't have any justifications or excuses, but it's a way that I'm learning from experience. So after all of these things, all of these stories we've learned about Nebuchadnezzar, in the end, he ends up learning his lesson. He's not too stubborn to get back on the path, and God's agenda gets done in his life. Like Nebuchadnezzar, we're all trees. We're all like the trees in his dream. The question is, will you be a rubber tree or an ironwood tree? Will you be flexible and open to growth in all of its forms, change, wisdom, failure? Or will you be firm and unyielding, shaped only by hammer blows? God has an agenda for us. The question is, how far are we going to get on that agenda? How painful is it going to be on the way? Are we dragging our feet on the path of sanctification? If we're open to it, God may just explain those lessons to us. He'll write it down or send us a podcast, or we'll see someone else experience it and we can learn from them. Or the lesson might come through change in our own lives. We can embrace that change and draw the lesson out of it. Or we can fight that change and hide from the lesson. But the change eventually will catch up to us. Or that lesson could come in our failures. Will we hide from failure and try to erase it? Or will we look to failure to give us the data we need to succeed? And I want to ask you, are you in the middle of dragging your feet? Because there is never a time when you can't stop walking forward. There's never a time when you can't repent of that stubbornness. You can always start running on the path of sanctification. Let's pray. God, please help us to not drag our feet. Make us run towards your kingdom. Over and over, you tell us not to fear. Make us brave in the face of change or failure. You said, blessed are the eyes that see and the ears that hear. We want open eyes and open ears. In James, you said, anyone who asks for wisdom, you will grant it. We want it. Amen. In a bit,